They change cultures. They're heat seekers. They run at adversity and embrace change. These are the Room Tilters.
Somebody who can change the temperature in a room when they walk in. Mm. And that's metaphorical for somebody who can influence those around them and make such an impact quickly, emphatically, and long-lasting, whether it be an organization, a team, a relationship, whatever it might be.
This is the Room Tilters podcast, presented by Limitless Minds. Co-hosts DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, founders of peak performance and leadership consulting company, Limitless Minds, explore how the best and brightest change the temperature in a room. From sports, the military, entertainment and media, clinical psychologists to CEOs, this podcast will navigate what it takes to think big and go far. And now, DJ and Harry.
Peyton Jenkins, man, excited to have you on the Room Tilters podcast. I've been wanting to interview you for a while here because we go back. And so I'm excited to tell people about our history as collegiate Cougars and whatnot. But how you been?
Really good, man. Yeah, I as a proud UVA alum, national championship now on my belt. I feel really, really good.
You know, what's funny is that, obviously I didn't go to UVA. I went to Richmond. And, you know, for most of my high school career, I wanted to go to UVA and it didn't work out. That's for another podcast. Yeah. but I still love UVA. My mom went there. My mom went there for undergrad. My dad went there for law school. Yeah. And so I have my UVA gear. And so I wore it around the airport the next day. And people asked me, did you go to UVA? And I was getting the question so many times. I just said yes and like went with it as I could because, you know, I feel like a national champion. Anytime you get a chance to do that. You roll with it.
Reminds me, I when my wife ran the Marine Corps Marathon, I jumped in for the last 3 miles and I'm not sure why, but I was wearing a Harvard t-shirt and this Marine comes up to me right after the marathon, wraps me in one of those, you know, space blankets. And he said, congratulations, young man. And he puts a medal around my neck. And I was like, oh, actually, I just ran the last 2 miles. he literally takes the medal off. Unwraps me and he goes, oh, I was class of such and such at Harvard. What year were you? And I was like, I didn't go to Harvard. And he's like, so you're a complete fraud. And I was like, yeah, pretty much.
You're a poser.
Hey, Harry, so quit making fun of me when I wear my Harvard shirt all the time, man.
We can all be posers and, you know, and pretend we went through these places. It's all good. Speaking of where we went to school, Peyton is a collegiate Cougar. It's the school that we went through. Peyton, were you there K-12?
I was.
I was not. I was a fourth grade on, but a lifer. We call it Cougar Tech. You know, in high school, Peyton and I played some sports together. I think we certainly played baseball together, right?
Basketball. Until it was clear that you were much better than me and you left me in the dust.
You know, the Cougar sports then were, you know, I think they're better now than they were then. I think when we came through, I don't know, I guess we had something to do with that. Honestly and seriously, Peyton was a well-respected leader and student athlete at collegiate. You know, one of those guys, DJ, that's kind of like the face of the school kind of person, you know, at least from my memory. So well respected. Right. So it's neat to see Peyton, some of what you and your co-founder have done with your organization, which I'll let you explain and tell folks about here in a second. And so I'm just really excited. You know, it's cool to see, you know, former friends and peers excel and do stuff different and disrupt different industries. And there's a lot of us out there. And so it's exciting. But if you don't mind, Peyton, kind of maybe telling our audience and DJ for that matter, you know, kind of some of your background that I haven't already mentioned and kind of set us up.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. I clearly have not paid you enough for your kind compliment. So born and raised in Richmond, Virginia. My dad was born in Richmond. My mom was born in a tiny little town called Emporia. And so I have Virginia roots through and through, both kind of city and country. Very proud of that. Went to, as you said, went to collegiate. I now have a kindergartner there. So
wow.
Hopefully this shout out can give me some sort of discount for next year. But, you know, collegiate was an amazing place for me. It was one of those where the kind of student teacher ratio was small enough that, you know, some folks could really invest in me and were kind of good stewards for me. And then, you know, being a student athlete, I was no athlete to write home about, but it was an environment where I could be competitive and it really taught me, you know, playing for people like Charlie Blair, who's, you know, our soccer coach for years and years, really taught me what it's like to be within a team, what it's like to have a healthy culture, what it's like to to recover from a bad culture. And I went from Richmond, 60 miles up the road, to UVA. Loved UVA. It was a really great environment for me. Again, a place where I could kind of carve out my own niche and have friends across every spectrum. And it was a hard environment. You know, it was, you know, academically was challenging. And that was one of the first times I've really struggled and been challenged, you know, academically. And it was, that was a good lesson for me, that it wasn't just always going to be easy. And, but as much as I love Richmond, as much as I love Charlottesville, it can be a fairly narrow corridor. So I took the next first year out of college and taught theology and British history in rural England. Yeah. You grow up a lot when you're a 23-year-old in a country of 80 plus million people and you don't know anyone. And then came back, was in the real estate world, worked for a real estate investment group in DC, really enjoyed it. Wasn't necessarily my passion, but great people. And from, I met my wife, as all great relationships are started, playing kickball. And yep, so that leg that I developed at collegiate, I led the league in runs kicked in. It's a stat that only I kept. And then moved to New York in January 2009 to start Alton Lane.
So you got to thank Charlie Blair for finding your wife.
I do. And Coach Blair, the relentless pursuit of excellence in kicking led me to my wife.
That's awesome. That's good, man.
And Peyton, I'm also known for my great legs too. Harry. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we have
I've heard that.
You know, and obviously he's being sarcastic because, you know, the thing about DJ is he'll go to the weight room and you'll never see him do a leg exercise. It's like 100% upper body. And so it's just DJ's, like, if you only right now, you can probably just see his, you know, his upper body. Like, he
focus on your strengths. We got to focus on your strengths, Peyton. Yeah. Right. So PJ, tell us a little bit about this, this journey to, co-founding Alton Lane. You know, just how'd you get there?
One of my best friends from college, Colin Hunter, was at Bain, kind of traveling around the world, consulting with all different types of industries. And the entrepreneur bug really hit him. And seeing a lot of these industries that were, you know, I guess what we would call now ripe for disruption, they had been kind of stayed and true for so long that a new economy of sorts was developing. And so this was early to mid 2000s. And Colin is a classic soccer player build. I'm 6'4", kind of a combination of like Manute Bol, Toby Maguire. Somebody actually told me that once. I'm not sure it was a compliment. But the same issue off the rack, nothing fit us. And as we were progressing in our careers, there was a need to dress to that next level. And while the fashion and styles were different then, the ultimate purpose of it was the same, is to look a certain part and to deliver confidence through your outward appearance and what you were wearing. And so there was something there that Colin knew, and he approached me with this idea, and I loved it. And it was this idea of, could we create an environment where men felt, on from one spectrum, at the very least, they felt comfortable, to the far other end of the spectrum, that they, an environment that they could not wait to right. spend time in. And then we deliver them clothing at an accessible price point that was a high degree of luxury. And we were coming out of the 2007 and 8 financial crisis, where value was becoming something more than just a lot for a little. It was becoming something that had investment quality to it. And that's really where kind of the origin of Alton Lane was formed.
Where did the name come from, Alton Lane?
I could give you a great sounding answer, but the reality is, it is a street in England. And I lived in England for a year, and flipping through pages of street names in England, we liked it.
It's like, you know, a horse name, you know what I mean? Like in the Kentucky Derby, exactly. Just literally, I've come up with so many different horse names. When I own a couple horses in the Derby, okay. I have plenty of names ready to go.
My number one horse name is Harry Wilson.
Can you imagine? And now down the stretch, Harry Wilson wins the 155th Kentucky Derby. I would love that. I would love that. So, I mean, you guys have talked about, you know, the passion to disrupt the industry, and I saw a quote where, you know, one of you said, you know, there has to be a better way to do this, right? And you guys thought that, you know, what if you could turn, you know, could do luxury for less cost, but double down on the engagement in the experience. And then I think, you know, there's obviously you guys have had success doing that, to the point where, you know, kind of, you know, folks are calling Alton Lane the future of bespoke design. To get there, all that, you know, you have to make a lot of sacrifice to tell me a little bit about that. Do you think that you guys have taken more risks or made more sacrifices on this journey?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think they're sometimes opposite sides of the same coin, but right out of the gates, we took a giant risk along with a big sacrifice. So we were very fortunate to remain gainfully employed through the financial crisis and when a lot of our friends were not. And we certainly didn't take that lightly, but we had this feeling that this crisis would end and this would be the best possible time to launch a business. And, you know, we ended up being right. I don't think that was any sage wisdom other than just a gut instinct. And so, you know, we took a sacrifice in leaving well-paying jobs to not make a salary for a year and a half living in New York City. And sometimes you'll hear in TED Talks entrepreneurs saying, oh, I knew exactly what I was doing. I had no idea what I was doing or, frankly, the risk that I was taking. And I didn't fully understand the sacrifice at the time. But one of the first and probably biggest risks we took was to deliver quality at an accessible price point. We knew we needed to produce overseas. But then the big question came, could you produce overseas in an environment that, not that you were okay with, but that you were proud of, in conditions that you were proud of, with quality employment? And so we didn't know the answer to that. So, but we'd already left our jobs. And so we flew to Asia. We landed in Bangkok just a couple weeks after Obama was inaugurated. And so I remember everybody was calling us Barack Obama, which is
they call me Barack Obama, man, too. So
yeah, you do resemble. Unfortunately, because I think he's like devastatingly handsome, unfortunately, I do not resemble him.
I knew I liked him.
So, we had a contact there, and we went shop to shop, trying to meet people, trying to understand where things are produced. We saw a lot of places we weren't happy with. And really condensing a long story down, we found a place that we were really, really proud of. And no one spoke English, so we had to hire an interpreter. And, you know, we just figured it out. And I think as seasons of Alton Lane have moved forward, and as I'm now a 37-year-old, I think that I have made more sacrifice than risk, which I'm not always proud of. And what I mean is my wife and I have two kids. First couple years of marriage, I didn't see my wife a ton. You know, I would generally leave before she woke up, get back after she went to bed. And and I think that I'm now in a season where I'm much more willing to take unmeasured risk and much less willing to take unmeasured sacrifices. Because I've come to a point where I have a deep faith. I believe strongly in the power of family, and those things have to be in right priority with the sacrifice and risk that I take in the workplace.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful. And I think as people go into this journey, you know, to be an entrepreneur, you talk about the risk and the sacrifice. It's I think that really, really resonates well. So I appreciate you sharing that, Peyton. What's your biggest fear? And you know, maybe now, and then what was your biggest fear before as you were kind of going through that that journey?
It's a really good question. You know, at the beginning stages, I was just so naive to what this journey would take that to me it was actually this like beautiful protection mechanism. Because I think that if most people understood the road ahead, most people wouldn't go down it. You know, you just find a good rest stop and just stay there. And there's nothing wrong with that. I was just wired a little differently. And so I didn't have too many fears early. I was so amped up. But then once we took on investor dollars, a consistent fear of mine over the years has been to not return an investment for them, to not prove their investment in us worthy. And that's something that sticks with me to this day. That has played out in certain ways where we've made less than bold decisions to protect as opposed to grow. And I think that protect and grow is a interesting paradigm, you know, to think about as you take risk. Today, looking back, I think that probably my biggest fear is, what am I working for? And is it for just to return an investor dollar? Is it just to have a successful brand? Is it for creating a place that our people can thrive in and grow? And is it a place where, you know, I can put on display the values that I want to try to instill in our home as a, you know, as a good husband and father? And I think the last two have grown into my biggest fears, but also drivers of creating an environment where our people can thrive, not love every day. I think that's unrealistic, but can thrive and can, where it can be a professional environment that allows them to meet their professional and personal goals.
Well, I mean, you know, I know that not just wanting to kind of enter in to, you know, this space that you guys are in, but to revolutionize it, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, DJ and I certainly respect, right? That's what we're trying to do with, you know, training and soft skills and mindset and all this other stuff that we're trying to do with Limitless Minds. But, you know, to do that, right, and it kind of goes with the sacrifices and risks as well, is we talk about this concept of the illusion of choice. It's one that our co-founder, Trevor Moad, talks about quite a bit. And so it's kind of a foundation of some of our curriculum. It's been the foundation of many programs. One of the biggest and best dynasties that exists, Alabama football, and Nick Saban talks about this. You can find it on YouTube. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But really what that means is that if we want to be great, or if we want to revolutionize an industry, if we want to disrupt a market, whatever it is, right? If you want to be the best athlete, best teacher, fireman, policeman, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
You realize that you really don't have that many choices, right? In many cases, you might have one choice or a couple of sets of choices. You really don't have any choice, right? If you want to be great, you have to do what it takes to be great, whatever that is for that particular role or experience, whatever it might be. The reason why I want to ask you about sacrifices and risk, I mean, the reality is, to me, I think that, you know, sacrifice and risk is quite a bit of a meshing and an overlap there, right? You know, you're taking risks when you sacrifice X, Y, or Z, right? When you concept the illusion of choice, how does that manifested kind of in the growth of your business or personal, you know, personal growth as well?
It's a really interesting concept. And I think that early on for us to be great, I think greatness was not defined as being the most known brand in the world or the best custom clothier in the world. To be great was to frankly do whatever it took to just survive the first couple of years. And we started Alton Lane in the kind of resurgence of Silicon Valley. We didn't take on any venture money, raise money from friends and family and customers. And, you know, from the get-go, we've been outsized, outmanned, but, you know, we've had to figure out other ways, you know, to be great. And so you don't always know the choices you have until they're right in front of you. And there are times where the choice to get a little bit closer to greatness is either to stop or just keep moving. And in any journey, you'd love to have the destination in sight. You'd love to know exactly where you're going. And I think one of the biggest challenges as an entrepreneur is that you don't always know where or what the destination is. You know that in certain seasons, you just got to keep it going. And, you know, that's been a consistent theme of ours. And I think that as we have gotten into this season, we're starting to see actually what that destination for Alton Lane, you know, could look like. And pursuant to one of my earlier comments on some of the perspective that I have now is that a good buddy of mine and mentor, a guy named Fritz, has been good at encouraging me that, or helping me understand that I'm the kind of guy that I always want to be part of something epic. And he told me that, you know, the most epic thing that I can do is to be a good husband and a good father and to prepare our kids for when they get to that next step in life. And he told me about this article, and it'll sound funny, but I wasn't a big Simpsons guy, but it was, I think it was in the New York Times, and it was an article on Ned Flanders that he was actually like, it said he was the hero that America needed. And it was that he's a next door neighbor and he's just always there. He's always there to say good morning. He's always there to say good evening. And as I think about that with my work and home, is that I want to be constantly there for our people, for our team, want to be constantly, not necessarily present, but constantly mindful of making the fiduciary decisions to push our company forward in both what's best for the customer, because what's ultimately best for our customer is going to be best for our investor. And then being that consistent, maybe not always bold, epic manner, but, you know, consistently there for my family. And so, yeah, if I had to choose between being known as being great in my home or great in the workplace, I think I've been able to develop a perspective of that. I would certainly choose the home, but, you know, fortunately, I don't think that's a, you know, a choice that I have to make.
You know, something my brother and I talk about all the time is don't be afraid of consistency, right? Consistency is, you know, one of the best qualities, both from a leadership perspective or even as an individual performer. And I was going to ask you, and you kind of touched on it a little bit, is, you know, when you guys started Alton Lane, you were probably what, like 26 years old or so?
I was the ripe old age of 27. Yeah.
27 years old. Right. So, I mean, like, I know that I'm quite a bit different now at 35, heading to 36 than I was at 25, 26, 10 years ago. You know, how have you changed as a leader? Clearly it sounds like now you have, I got this high level of conscientiousness. I can't even say the word.
He's got it though.
Conscientiousness, you know, and maybe you have that at 27, but what do you think is kind of the leadership quality that maybe has changed the most for you now that you have a business that's a decade old?
I love the question. When we started, I really thought that being a good leader and being a great manager are the same thing. I've always enjoyed being a public face of something, whether it's a school, a team, a company, an organization. And I have learned that they are so different. And I've come to see that my greatest leadership ability is, or one of them, is not actually in the day-to-day management of a whole bunch of people. I'm an okay manager. I'm not a best-in-class manager of people. And I think that that has been probably the most important realization for me. Whereas for years, I really wanted to believe that I was a great manager of people, because that had to be a key piece of leadership. And where I have seen that my leadership is best used in our business is in two areas. I love people and I love talking to people. And so putting myself in positions where I can do that and where I can develop our business around that. And then two, you know, Harry, you just kind of said it, is consistency. Is I want to be more and more in positions that allow me to be kind of to have my hand on the pulse of our culture and our internal people. Because, you know, as a startup that's constantly undermanned from a funds perspective, you know, our balance sheet looks a lot different than our competitors. There are seasons where, you know, you ask far more of your people than they can deliver on. And so it's in those seasons that being there for them in non-standard and uncommon ways is critical. And I think that that's where I've learned probably my leadership is best served, because some people just aren't wired to be in that moment. And I crave being in that moment.
No, I love that. You know, this podcast really is wrapped around this whole concept of tilting a room and kind of debunking the notion that charisma is all it takes, right, to tilt a room and to be a leader. And I'm certain this probably resonates with you, you know, based on talking to you about it. But I mean, you've seen probably different individuals come through, you know, in and out the Alton Lane doors as employees. Yeah. And you've worked with different leaders and you've, whether it be, you know, all the way back to collegiate, right? Yeah. Through UVA and beyond. How does that resonate with you, that whole concept of tilting a room?
It's a really, really interesting concept. And I think it has so much to do on the environment. So I'll share kind of three environments of Alton Lane. There's the showroom where we do 90% of our sales in our stores. There's the kind of day-to-day headquarter, you know, management environment. And then there is the strategy management meetings, right? So on the floor, the room tilters, some of the best folks that I have worked with are folks that they have that sixth sense that in for people, which I view as kind of an EQ that's just off the charts. And they know the exact questions to ask in order to get you to a garment that they know is going to make you more confident. Okay. I don't believe that visual appearance is where we should find the majority of our confidence or worth by any means, but what we are dressing and wearing every single day will either positively or negatively affect your own sense of self. And they have that ability to ask the questions to get you there. So then when you wear that garment to work or to the event or to on a date and somebody compliments you, you cannot wait to go back and work with your person in the Altman showroom. So the person that tilts the room in our showroom is that person that has that EQ that's off the charts to know, all right, I have such a strong emotional intelligence. I know how to get you to be the more confident version of yourself. And as much as I love people, I'm not necessarily that person in our store. Now, in our day-to-day headquarters, it's really being what I said earlier, is being at the pulse of where people are. And I do believe that when I am in our headquarters, I know that I can, there's a certain energy that I can bring to others. And in using your terminology of tilting the room, I think it's because this might be where charisma plays into it a little bit, in that there is an energy that I can give that other people want to absorb. And whether that's through charisma in a public setting, or whether that's just sitting down and listening to where you are today, that's going to tilt the, that might tilt the room for one individual in our headquarters. And it might not do anything in that moment for somebody that's sitting on the other side of the room, but that person's going to then be able to have a certain energy and a certain confidence of having been invested in, that they can then go do that for others. And so there's this viral room tilting. Take our strategy meetings. I can bring all the charisma I want into the strategy meetings. That doesn't, charisma is not a strategy, man. My co-founder, Colin, is the biggest room tilter on strategy that I have met, because he has that ability to, if we think about your brother in football, we think about you, Harry, playing football and seeing the pocket before it's there and being able to see the right route before it actually opens up. I think that's what is such a room tilter from a strategy perspective, is that kind of off the charts IQ, but then being able to take the IQ and relate it to actual day-to-day business and how it can affect the business in real day. And so you have these kind of three different environments that we at Alton Lane kind of work in every day. And I may have a positive effect in that HQ environment, but just because I can maybe tilt a room there, that is in no way transferable into the boardroom, into a strategy meeting, into the sales environment. You need to make sure that we as business owners are finding the right people in the right places for the right roles that can frankly do what we can't do in every environment.
Yeah, I really like that, Peyton. You said the top, sales folks on the floor, they're focused on questions. It's not about them. It's about the customer. And when they're asking those questions, they're trying to determine what that customer really needs so that they can bring some kind of value to them. And I agree with you. I think that's what we see the room tilters, whether they're in a sales role or a leadership role, it becomes about their people. That bleeds through with room tilters. The other thing you mentioned that I really liked was the whole vision. These room tilters are looking to see the opportunities that are out there and forecasting a strategy accordingly. And then B, also the pitfalls that could come up so that they have a way to get around through or over them. I really appreciate you sharing that. That's really good stuff.
Yeah. And Peyton, you also mentioned earlier that kind of one of your strengths in leadership is, really having your pulse on the people and the culture. And obviously we know that's important, especially for a company like yours or a company like ours that's on a growth track, right? And because the bigger you get, even if you remain a small business, right, the bigger that you get, the more the culture continues to evolve. Yeah. And the people are the foundation of that. And talent acquisition is challenging in itself, right? Because it's like a batting average. It's, you're not going to bat 1,000. No. But it's, so it's a challenge, right, to kind of maintain the culture, yet let it evolve, right? And I think that's really challenging. At least it's been challenging. It's going to be challenging for us. It's been challenging for businesses that I've been at. Is allow, especially as a leader in leadership role, is to allow the culture to evolve. Sometimes you want to keep it. You think it's great the way it is. I mean, let it be what it is forever. But letting it evolve naturally is a good thing. How have you and Colin navigated company culture as you've grown?
Oftentimes, especially early, we navigated without a map, which is apparently is not recommended. Culture is a challenge in any organization. It's not like once you get to the size of Nike, culture becomes easy. In many ways, it's a lot harder. From kind of always being, we felt like kind of behind the curve from our competitors, culture can be something that it's super easy in the early days, even the mid days, to underappreciate and underinvest in, and just hoping that, hey, because we have strong personalities and good personalities, we're good people, a culture will naturally develop from that. Maybe that's true in some cases, but it's not. Culture will fill whatever void you leave. And if that void you leave is, let's say, poor communication from the top down, because not on purpose, right? But we've had seasons where we've moved so fast that, man, we have to shift on a dime and we don't communicate that well, then what is the culture of that season develop? One of poor communication. And if you don't fix that, then culture can then turn into distrust, to wondering what's going on. About a year and a half ago, we brought on a woman who is now head of retail for us. And she has a background with Aviva, Lululemon, Anthropology, Ralph Lauren. Mm-hmm. What she really developed in her days with Lululemon and Aviva was this idea of radical candor, that candor without empathy is not very helpful, and empathy without candor is destructive to the individual. And so trying to find that upper right quadrant of high candor, high empathy, and that is not easy when that's not part of an organization and you try to instill it. Everyone needs accountability. Most people aren't asking for it. And so that's been really a strong push over the past year and a half. And you're right. It's a batting average. You're not batting 1,000. Hopefully you're batting better than Chris Davis. but you know, our batting average is going up. And I think that it's going up in part because of this strong push that in a people first organization, our most important people, it's easy to say the customer. We have come to understand, I think, in this latest iteration of our business, that our customer will never be consistently taken care of better than our internal people. And that's the environment we now find ourselves in, is trying to hit a better batting average with our internal culture by being one of radical candor in a people first environment.
That's really strong. I'm picturing that upper right quadrant of empathy and candor. We gotta find that. We gotta find that balance, brother.
You know, it's funny though too, Peyton. I wonder, you know, how much does trust play into that? You know, because you know, you talk about that quadrant. Tell me a little bit about trust and how it plays into that.
Yeah, well, something you guys actually both hit on earlier is consistency. Is that, you know, think about the people you trust. It's not necessarily just the nicest people, and it's not people that have always been correct. It's people that, you know, are in positions of influence over you, or peers that are radically consistent. And I think that with that idea of radical candor, of this idea of where empathy meets candor, it's really hard if you do it once or twice and then you don't apply it into your own workday. And when you come into an organization, you don't just naturally trust people because you don't know them yet. But if you see people that are consistent in the empathetic candor they're giving you, and then they're consistent in being able to receive that themselves, I think that really does help build trust. Without trust, I honestly don't think radical candor is possible. I think you hit on the kind of core foundation of it.
Whether it's an organization or as an individual, you know, that whole room tilter quality, right? I think that room tilters probably are able to capture the trust of those that, whether they're influencing them or their peers, quickly and consistently. I think that's good stuff. Well, let's jump to the future as we close out and before we let you go. Peyton, what are some of your personal goals for the next 5 to 10 years?
I think that one of the mistakes that I made, certainly, and probably a lot of people make with starting businesses, is they don't set personal goals, that their personal goals become their business goals. And then your personal worth is tied to your business worth. But no matter what, it's someday you sell that business, it's someday the business doesn't exist anymore, it's someday it doesn't go well. And then, you know, you find yourself in this like personal worth vacuum. And I've done that, and I've made that mistake too many times. And so, you know, over the next 5 years from a work perspective, really want to make Alton Lane a business that is sought after from an investment perspective, from a purchase perspective, but more so from a experience perspective, by sought after by our competitors, that they want their business. They either want our business or they want their businesses to be more like ours. And I think that we do that. And then that, of course, implies financial success for the company. But I think we do that by continuing to run sacrificially, frankly, towards a people first environment. From a personal goal, I really want to find continue to hone in on balance. You know, I think there are seasons where you have to give every hour you have to your business. Those aren't just in the early days, but I think that for me, the better husband, father, civic member of our city, very passionate about the city of Richmond, about what we're doing here, about making it a place that is great for everyone, not people that just look like me. And the more that I can do that, the better leader and executive at Alton Lane I'm going to be. That's my main goal, is a life of balance. You know, I think everything in moderation. And as somebody that seeks epic stories, I've never really met moderation. And so I think that that's something that probably everyone around me would appreciate me finding sooner than later.
Now that's really admirable. You know, I mean, I think that there's a reason why, you know, I wanted to set this time up with you, because, you know, we haven't really gotten a chance to spend really any time communicating over the last decade. But I've been watching from a distance what you've built, and knowing that it's not easy to do that, and you're not doing it on your own, right? But knowing that it's not easy to do that, there had to be something there that kind of was a recipe that you were, you know, throwing in there. And I think that you, Colin, your team, Alton Lane, have really and continue to develop that. And so kudos to you guys. It's really, really, really exciting. I think that, you know, from a Room Tilter perspective, I think you fall into that category. So DJ's going to quarterback these next questions because they're rapid fire. DJ, you want to?
So, so we'll just go down through a couple questions here. Peyton, favorite book?
Shoe Dog.
Nice.
Yeah, I loved it.
There you go. So favorite musical artist?
Currently, actually, probably the past 5 or 6 years, it's been Old Crow Medicine Show, which I know that's Harry's a huge fan of Old Crow.
If I'm in Richmond, what restaurant do I absolutely have to go to?
Without a doubt, you have to go to the Roosevelt. It's okay. My favorite restaurant in Richmond. It's one of the coolest environments.
Last one, what would you like to be remembered for?
When it's all said and done, consistently making God bigger than myself in my life and others. And I think that one of my biggest challenges is having this giant view of myself that can overinflate your own sense of worth sometimes. And that's something that, you know, that I really am working on. And that's the stuff that's going to matter to me.
That's right. Iron sharpens iron, right? That's biblical. 100%. And I feel like I was sharpened today by you. A lot of really good nuggets here. I know Harry's going to close it out, but I would be remiss if I didn't say that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So, Peyton, so where can folks find Alton Lane? So, I mean, from the standpoint of where are you guys located?
So we currently have 12 showrooms in 11 cities. Our two flagships are in New York in Flatiron and Tribeca. And then most major cities along the Eastern Seaboard, we are as far west as Nashville, Chicago, and Dallas. Mm-hmm. And, we're doing a big fundraise this year, and we'll be starting to expand again next year. And then you can always find us at altonlane.com.
Nice. You're going to go to the West Coast and end up out there?
Yeah. I'd love to be on the West Coast. I'd love to be in Portland, Seattle, Bay Area, LA, San Diego, basically all the cities that I love.
But hey, thanks for joining us, man. I really appreciate
you. Thank you guys.
Looking forward to seeing what happens next with Alton Lane.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure, really.
You've been listening to the Room Tilters podcast, hosted by DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, presented by Limitless Minds.